The middle of the day in winter finds me in the storage unit that I rent, going through a bunch of different materials to find four very large boxes, labeled medium, but nothing of the sort, filled with floppy disks. These floppy disks were given to me in July, and some very kind people helped me pack them up and get them to the nearest FedEx location to be sent ground, handled roughly, and stored for months. I'm not even sure how many floppy disks these are. It's gotta be in the hundreds, maybe the thousands. And lifting them into my car made me think a little bit about the issues of what's behind them, and thinking a little more about the history that I deal in, the projects I do, and what it all means. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, William Hearn, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. These thousands of floppy disks are part of the now legendary Kansas Fest 2019 haul. It officially came from two different collectors who had passed on, but it feels like a combination of even more. Taking the time to go through them now and think about the themes in them, I'm finding several schools, several user groups, and of course the endless handwritten labels where you can't even figure out who did what when. And even, I'll say, one or two vintage computer stores. There's 5 1/4 inch, there's 3 1/2 inch, and a bunch of commercial boxes, most of them Apple II, with a few DOS piles thrown in for good measure. At Kansas Fest, on a year when I said I was going to take it easy, we ended up setting up a very involved 3- and 4-station fluxing and imaging assembly line with lots of volunteers working on it, including myself and 4 a.m., trying to triage what did we need the most and what was most likely going to have to get special treatment. By the way, the value system is variant, but it's definitely important to get commercial discs that are in some pristine form to ensure that the pirated versions don't go on becoming the only versions for the future. After that, it's user groups, which are compilations of works done by just folks. And then after that, if you're lucky, you're going to find things from businesses, things from schools, and all sorts of between-the-cracks pieces that were created by folks tinkering around at an Apple II that you can make live again. I honestly thought this was the year I was going to sit back and just enjoy myself, but we ended up doing this for hours on end throughout the entire event, and as it got towards Saturday, I ended up organizing us putting these hundreds upon hundreds of discs into boxes and then shipping them off, which was an entire adventure in itself. When they arrived here at my home, I put them away in storage and focused on other things, making sure that my workspace was clean enough, that any commitments I had made with my different materials at my house were handled, and then preparing for my own home version of the assembly line. But let's take a step back on all this. What's the value here? What are we doing this for? Why are we putting so much effort into making perfect magnetic flux copies of things? And what am I learning the further I go down this rabbit hole? Well, first of all, it really helps if the material has some sort of historical significance to you as the person who's ingesting it. Not everyone is so lucky with that. Sometimes we have a job where we're doing something in this space and you just have stuff that needs to be digitized or needs to be cataloged and you have no personal stake in it whatsoever. You might take a kind of roundabout interest in what's going by and point out some of the unique points about it, but it's your job. You can't just go for the interesting baubles and let the rest stay around. You might end up with 1,000 cataloged items and never meet the people who will benefit from your work or even know if there's going to be a person like that. In the case of these floppies, they're all in a pretty standardized format. They come on this 5 1/4 inch floppy. It's a black square that I know how to align correctly each and every time. It goes into a floppy drive. I have to clean the floppy drive constantly because of the gunk and dust, but I just start out with the beginning of the pile and move on to the end. Describing them is variant. I belong to a school of thought that says it's nice to have the outside information, but that the information itself often speaks for itself. You can create scripts that go through and figure out what's on the disk, whether it's unique, what attributes it has, make it run through an emulator, show it on a screenshot, collect all of it together and be able to browse through it and find things that are of interest to you or that you need to search for. Working on this takes about 40% of my brain, just making sure that I'm doing everything right and that I can respond to errors. That leaves a lot of room for boredom. What I personally end up doing is listening to podcasts as well as watching YouTube videos that go on for a half an hour or an hour trying to teach me something. The idea being that I can get some sort of education, some sort of enrichment personally, where even though I may have just copied 50 to 100 floppy disks, I also learned an awful lot about a technique or a tool making set or the history of a place that I wanted to know about. I try to build a layer cake in my life of not just doing one thing. In these floppy disks are entire histories, people who, faced with Apple II, wanted to create on it, were assigned to create on it, made it part of their business or their lives, or reached out to others and copied software for entertainment, passed along things they liked, kept them around, and wore the discs into oblivion, playing them over and over again. Lives lived by the disc insertion, the booting up, and the experimentation. There's about 400 of us who have applesauce units. John Morris, the creator, tells me he has sold a pretty good amount. If you want to get one, it does what it promises. And this community works with each other to understand bizarre protection schemes, track down which disks have been handled, and making tools that go beyond ingestion and moving into analysis. As an indication of how deep this can go, I've talked before about my Screen Shotgun, which is the program that plays all of these emulated works, takes shots, finds unique shots, and then puts them up on the archive. That's great, except there's an entire class of Apple II programs that are actually compilations. People would crack a game or just make a program, and then they would put it together on a menu-driven disk. I could show you the menu, but you still wouldn't know exactly what those programs were like. So I wasted a day trying to figure out how to make it go in, try every item on the menu, screenshot all of the programs in that menu, and then put them together. I don't have a name for it, but it is working. So I'm going from a few thousand title screenshots to probably 5,000 or 6,000 to get each of these programs. It was really frustrating trying to make this work, and along the way I talked to a bunch of people, including the creator of the XDo tool, which is a obscure utility for connecting to X window sessions and doing a variety of keyboard and mouse commands to be able to make it look like a person is using it for some obscure person in the future. My recommendation to you, if you are trying to make an emulated system running in a browser, in a headless X system, work, be sure to remember that you have to press the key down for at least 100 milliseconds before releasing it. You're welcome. All of this is going directly onto the Internet Archive, and I'm using hashing to make sure the disks aren't already up there, and this is how I'm going to spend 2020. Do I think this is all a really good idea? I'm not sure. Do I think it's a bad idea? Absolutely not. But there's two other testimonies in this situation that I am thinking about and which I thought I would share. The first one is a rather prominent artist who lived for a bunch of years doing comic books and other illustrations, who died recently. In the last couple years of his life, he had gotten a Patreon, and on that Patreon, he had thrown himself into it, making lots of posts, putting up all sorts of unique items from his collection or newly made to share with his patrons. He took it really seriously, just like he took a lot of his work very seriously. I only met him once at a Comic-Con. We talked for about 5 or 6 minutes. It was just me telling him how much of an influence he had been on me when I was a teenager, and how much I loved the work he had done. Imagine my surprise when, sometime after his death, an artist connected me to his widower, who was trying to make sense of the Patreon archive and needed help because there was already an archive of the artist's work out there that had all been arranged. But what about all of this late-stage work? Did we want to have it disappear, or would there be some way that somebody could step forward and help them get it off to the official permanent archive? I quickly volunteered. I explained who I was and why this all mattered to me. And in an incredible showing of trust, he handed me the passwords, and I am now in the process of moving all of this work from the Patreon into various permanent or semi-permanent formats that I hope that researchers and fans and others will be able to access for many decades to come. I'm not comfortable giving the artist's name yet until it's all done, but it was really striking to me to find that we don't really have a control of knowing who we're going to end up with and who's going to step in and who's going to become your caretaker of your legacy. A similar situation occurred when Cade Metz, now working at the New York Times and previously of Wired, contacted me because Randy Seuss, the co-creator of the computerized bulletin board system, had died. He said he was looking for any information I might know, what my impressions of him were, and if there was any material I could provide him in his research. I gave him access to the BBS documentary of him, I told my story of talking to him, and I got him as much contact information as I could for his family, for his BBS that was still up and is still up, and of course to find Ward Christensen, his collaborator and long ago partner. Now, just to make sure this is known, I think Randy Seuss was completely nonplussed by me. The weeks I was working in Chicago to do the BBS documentary, he wasn't interested in reaching out to me. Efforts to talk to him got no response, and it was only the efforts of someone named Peter Zelchenko, who was a fan of Randy's and whose father had been heavily involved in bulletin boards, that any of this happened. Peter promised me that he would be my personal Sherpa in reaching Randy Seuss. The way we did it was that we went to a local bar near Randy's house, and then Peter contacted Randy and offered pizza. He said Randy'll go for the pizza. When Randy agreed to the pizza, we drove over to Randy's apartment, and even though he wasn't completely happy I was there, he did enjoy the pizza, and then sat down on his couch and answered questions for about 2 hours about the history of BBSs and his thoughts about computers and what it all meant. I would have never gotten any of this if it wasn't for Peter. And here it was, a little less than 20 years after that interview, that a screenshot from that interview became Randy's obituary photo in the New York Times. I thought Cade did a really good job. He got all sorts of quotes from folks, he gave a good perspective on what Randy had done, and he really showed the link between the efforts of people like Randy and Ward to the world that we live in today. Of course, Randy had no idea when he had the pizza and allowed someone like me to come in, some Weasley filmmaker, to have me end up being the person who provided the final image for his obituary and to link the New York Times reporter to all the folks that could talk about Randy after he was gone. But that's kind of the nature of the life we live. We don't know who's going to play what part in our lives, who's going to become our best friends, who's going to become our worst enemies. In an ideal world, you treat everyone you meet like they're going to be the ones to talk about you after you're gone. Scott Beal of Laughing Squid tells me that when he puts photos out, he asks himself, if this person had a funeral and they put this photo up at the funeral, would the person have been embarrassed by it? That's kind of his personal guideline for portrait photos, and it's a pretty good one. Randy and this artist are not the first person I've had to show up to at the end of their lives or after the end of their lives and play a part in securing their legacy or securing at least their possessions and papers. It's not going to be the last. But as I am handling these thousands of black squares, these portals into Apple II history now gone, I think to myself, what a pretty good life it is, and what a fantastic way to spend another evening in winter. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Forrest Fuqua, Mark Pilgrim, and Scott McCrady, as well as the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt.